Welcome to a special week-long series, Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm your MC, Alan Minsky. This series is informed by the fact, and I would argue it's a journalistic fact, that 3 years into the gravest economic crisis since the Great Depression, the vast majority of Americans have no significant political movement that truly represents their interests. Since I've been organizing the series, as you can imagine, many people have approached me and asked me, why use the term left at all? If you say left, then you're setting up an opposition to something called right, and it's not really a movement for all peoples. But left is a meaningful term, both politically and economically, and I think particularly poignant at the moment. However else we may look at the current political and social situation in the United States, it is certainly true that the gap between the wealthy and the vast majority of the society has been steadily increasing in recent years, and I think many people, probably the majority of people in the society, recognize it has reached crisis levels. The political left is the shorthand for the political movements and forces that represent that vast majority of people versus the empowered few. Also in the realm of politics, the money, in particular the money of the wealthy and powerful private institutions, mostly corporations, has now so skewed the political system that once again the vast majority of people need a voice. So both economically and politically, it's my sense that the moment cries out for a powerful left. And yet, where there should be a powerful left, there is largely a void, and hence this series. But as we all know, simply to wish it does not make it come true. To build a left in this country, and a powerful left, because truly a powerful political force is what's needed, will take the participation of millions upon millions of people. So what is it that I hope to achieve in this series? Well, first, I think it's just something to frame the question, as I think just the asking of the question is very essential at this point. And as I just made reference, the question once asked, it's not easy to provide an adequate answer. But on the other hand, there are some things that are as clear as day. In a society with 2 million people imprisoned, a nation leaving the largest carbon footprint in the history of humanity, at a time that the Earth's fragile ecosystem is under attack, where there is a poverty draft that provides the manpower for the maintenance of an empire imposing itself against the wills of people across the globe, where millions upon millions of people hold on to low-paying jobs they despise out of economic fear, and the numbers who fall into poverty has now reached a historic high, it is clear as day that this society could be better. It is clear as day to anyone who thinks of it that the direction it needs to go is the direction broadly defined by a powerful left. We all know we can do tremendously better, and hopefully this series will contribute to helping us just get to it and do the hard, inspirational work of building a powerful left in the United States. On today's first installment of Building a Powerful Left in the United States, we start off with Dolores Huerta as we talk about her initiative to weave movements together, which certainly sounds like a good strategy to build a left. Then we talk to Anthony Arnov, who provides some historical perspective. Anthony Arnov worked closely with the late historian Howard Zinn on the Voices of the People's History of the United States. We then speak to Stephen Duncombe, a professor of media studies at NYU. While we must learn from history, we must also recognize what is unique about the moment we're in now, and one aspect of that is a media landscape that evolves seemingly at breakneck speed week by week. Then we talk to Bill Fletcher Jr. and start to get into the brass tacks of what a powerful left could look like, how it might be organized, and what ideas may animate that. And then we'll hear from Stanley Aronowitz, a man who has devoted his long career into looking at the left in the United States, and we'll hear him focus on certain central points that he feels need to be addressed as the left revitalizes itself in the present. All that on this first show of Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And up next, Dolores Huerta. This is Alan Minsky, and welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And to get our series going, I thought we would start with the person whom I consider to be the emeritus organizer in the contemporary United States, Dolores Huerta. From her legendary work with the United Farm Workers through to her present work overseeing the Dolores Huerta Foundation, Dolores Huerta has done as much as any living citizen in the United States to help out the lives of the people in our society. Welcome to the series, Dolores Huerta.
Great to be here.
one of the other reasons I wanted to start the series off right away with you is because just a few months ago at your birthday celebration, you were talking about a new initiative called Weaving Movements Together. And it struck me as an initiative to try to build a strong left in the United States. So tell the listeners a little bit about Weaving Movements Together.
Well, I wanted to celebrate my 80th birthday because I've now had about 50 years of organizing and do it in sort of to reflect not only my life but what I felt was something that we really, really need in order to build a progressive movement. And so at my 80th birthday concert that we had at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles on August the 13th, we had representatives from the different movements. We had Martin Sheen, Jody Evans from the Peace Movement, Danny Glover, Van Jones from the Environmental Movement with Ed Begley. We had Hilda Solis, Secretary of Labor, Marilena Durazo, to kind of reflect about the labor movement. We had Nick Chavez and some music there about the very important LGBT movement that we need to, you know, really make sure it really happens. We get that equality here. We had Benjamin Bratt to talk about the immigrant rights movement. And so we tried to, you know, have a reflection of all of our different movements. Alfred Woodard was our MC that we had at the event. And, of course, we had great performances by Carlos Santana, Zach de la Rocha, Peter Escobedo, and the great Lila Downs. So it was a fabulous, fabulous event. And it had a great spirit. And, of course, the message that we wanted to get out there is that we've all got to work together. And if we don't do this, we're not going to win. We're not going to win because... And I use the example when we had an immigrant rights march in Washington, D.C., where we had 200,000 people marching for immigrants' rights. But at the same moment that that was going on, you know, they were voting on the health care bill in the Congress. At the same moment, you might say. And they were, of course, having a lot of trouble getting people to, you know, kind of push that one over the top there. We saw the same thing when we had the big peace march. Then the Green Action March right after it, the events, and at the same time that was going on, they were doing the confirmation of Supreme Court Roberts for the Supreme Court. And there was just this big, big disconnect. And I really feel that the only way that we're going to be able to win our progressive agenda is we can get all of our different movements to come together and not be working in silos, because it's like everybody has their own little issue that they're working on. But the pressure is not being put on the Congress, that we're not getting together to make sure that we get the right people elected. We just saw what happened in this last election that we had in November, where we have a lot of conservatives that were elected to the Congress because a lot of the progressives stayed at home and didn't vote.
Well, one more question on the particular strategy of Weaving Movements Together, and then I'd like to hear your reflections on the contemporary state of the American left. As you go back decades through American history and the history of the left, there seems to have been a greater focus upon economic disparities, combating economic disparities, and focusing on the economy as a central issue and organizing principle of the left. As you are working on Weaving Movements Together, the whole range of movements that you describe that aren't focused on, you know, wages for workers and labor rights and the economy, is your sense, though, that those movements, those very progressive movements, are receptive to having economic justice also be a part of a core aspect of their work?
Well, in a way, when you think about what's happening, the reason that a lot of the people did voted in for conservatives was because they were unemployed or because they've had these problems with their homes, losing their homes, you know, the whole mortgage crisis that people have gone through. And this is why a lot of people voted the way that they did vote. And they're definitely tied in together. But one of the things, I think we have this huge gap of information or misinformation that people know, yeah, I lost my house, and yes, I don't have a job, but they don't know who to blame, and they're blaming Obama, they're blaming the Democrats, and there might be some blame there, I'm sure, but they're not looking at, you know, what really caused the problem, you know, why we had this economic disaster in our country, and they're not looking to see it's to the source of the problem. And this is where I think that maybe we on the left, we need to do a lot more education. And I know it would seem that because of the Internet and whatever, that it would be easier. And I believe that maybe a lot of people do reach each other through the Internet to relay information. But then we have this whole bunch of people that we're not reaching. and that are getting their information from Fox News or Glenn Beck or O'Reilly, and they don't even know, you know, what the source of the problem is, where it's coming from, and they're blaming the wrong people. And when we think of what's happening to the labor movement, you know, the labor movement has just been, pounded on, and it's just shrunk so much. And if, when we think, though, I mean, when we think of California, okay, we are the model, so to speak, because we did what the rest of the country didn't do. When we consider that we got the most progressive people elected to our state government, starting with Jerry Brown and Kamala Harris, David Jones, and Gavin Newsom, all these folks got elected, but they were elected with the votes from Los Angeles. And a lot of those votes from Los Angeles came from the working class community, from the Latino, from the African-American community, and the work that Marielena Durazo, who headed up this incredible project, which she called One on One, going door to door. She had 10 sites throughout Los Angeles area, all the way from Burbank to San Fernando Valley to South Central, East Los Angeles, and way out there on way on the east side of LA, way down in El Monte and all these other places, where people just went out there every day door to door, knocking on 300,000 doors, educating the voters. And this, I think, is what we need to do. But not only, in this case, it was the Central Labor Council of Los Angeles that did this work, but that all of our movements have to do this. I know that the LGBT movement has also been doing this, both Equality California and the Courage Campaign have also been going door-to-door to educate people to the issues of equality in marriage, and it's been extremely effective. And so we've we have to come back to that one-on-one, telling people, educating them on the issues, and yes, on the economic issues, because they don't understand it. They don't understand why it is that this system that we have right now is really taking advantage of working people and poor people, and they are the victims of the failures of our economic system.
You know, Dolores Huerta, obviously your standing in the progressive community is firmly established. And as you can imagine in this series, at this political moment, there are going to be people who are going to weigh in with the feeling that Obama is definitely somebody to work with, that a strong left movement should come from the base and that he'll be persuaded by it. We're also going to hear a lot of people who are very critical of Barack Obama of the first 2-plus years of his administration, in particular the strong roles that people from Wall Street have played in the administration and continue to play. You obviously know Barack Obama. You've worked with him closely. What is your sense? If a strong movement from the base were organized, do you believe that this administration and this president could be and would be responsive to that movement?
Well, I think they always have to be responsive. I've done political work now for the last 40-some years, and I find that this is the only thing that they respond to, because sometimes you have to work just as hard on your friends as you do on those that oppose you. And we need to put the pressure on not only Obama, but on the Congress people. When we think about immigration reform, everybody was saying, okay, it's Obama, it's Obama, it's Obama. Well, it was not just Obama, it was the Congress. It was the Congress that are the ones, and I like to keep reminding people, the Congress are the ones that make the laws. The president can just sign the law once it's passed, but the Congress is the one that makes the laws. If we can organize at the base, just the way we did in California for this election, no one thought that Meg Whitman, with all of her jillions of dollars, that she would be defeated so soundly. And I'm sure that the election of Kamala Harris for Attorney General was a big surprise to everybody. But again, it was the people's movement that made it happen. And we can make this, we can put the same kind of pressure on Obama. We can put the same kind of pressure on our Congress people. But it's got to come from the base. It's got to come from the people. And I think, I believe that we, with the left, yeah, we do have that right to criticize, and we should. But at the same time, it's got to be constructive criticism. You know, we have to also give solutions, not just criticize.
And lastly, just a very big picture. When you're out and about in American society, is your sense from your day-in, day-out activity, because I know you're still very involved in grassroots organization with very real people with a very real hands-on effect, is your sense that there is an appetite out there for a society that's organized along the lines of what would be broadly understood as a more progressive, more left, more socially just society, such that there's greater economic equity and that people have the freedom to live their lives as they choose, so long as, of course, they're not harming another person?
Oh, I believe so. I think people are hungry. They're hungry for information. And, we have to sometimes work a little to kind of let them know that they have been getting a lot of misinformation. And people always respond to organizing, but it takes time. time, it takes effort, it takes commitment, it takes staff. You know, during the Great Boycott, and I love to kind of put this example out there because I know we have between now and, you know, a couple of years, so between now and the next elections in 2012, that when we did the Great Boycott, it actually took us only a year and a half to organize all of the United States of America, you know, to get people to boycott grapes. And we got what, you know, millions of Americans stopped eating grapes, and the farmers were able to get some basic human rights at the workplace. So I think we can do this. If we can, again, take this whole idea of weaving movements together and go through our communities and get all of our progressive movements here. Let's meet. Let's meet in every congressional district, and then let's start doing an education campaign in our community. Whether we do it through the media, whatever media we can get, or we can do it through leafleting, town hall meetings, neighborhood organizations, whatever, we have some time. Because I believe that if we don't do something between now and 2012, what can happen in 2012 could make it much, much worse for all of us. Because all of the progress that we're making, we're just trying to hang on to it. And, you know, we're trying to hang on to it, make sure that we don't go backwards, we don't take more major steps back. And Obama has done a lot. I mean, he really has. And, of course, a lot of people don't really know what he's done because it hasn't been that well publicized out there. And Pelosi has done a lot, all of the Democratic Congress people. And of course, we wish that they could have done more. But the only way that we're going to get there is that we have to do the work. One of the things that we use in organizing farm workers is we always say to them, look, nothing's going to change unless you change it. You have to do the work. All of us have got to step up to the plate, and we've got to get committed, even if it's just a few hours, you know, a few hours a week, or whatever we can do, put some of our time, put some of our money, because we know that our country is going to suffer a lot if we don't.
Dolores Huerta, thank you so much for joining us here on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you very much, Alan.
We are joined now by Anthony Arnov, who is the author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, and also co-edited, along with Howard Zinn, Voices of a People's History of the United States. Welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States, Anthony Arnov.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
When you look back over American history, one of the questions, since at times there were great labor movements, other powerful social justice movements, however, the left, an organized left, as a consistent, powerful political force in the United States, did not get established here the way it did, say, in many Western European countries. What's your understanding of that?
I think the first thing you have to step back and kind of acknowledge that's unique about the U.S. political tradition is that, first of all, unlike any other advanced capitalist country, we never built a labor party in this country. That is a genuine party rooted in the traditions and organizations of the working class. You can go to any country in Europe, any other capitalist country in the world, and there will be some form of labor party. However weak, however limited, however compromised, and of course with the rise of neoliberalism, we can point to increasing compromises on the part of those labor parties. Nonetheless, in terms of the kind of institutions that they were accountable to, the politics that they were accountable to, they were able to put forward a set of policies around basic social welfare needs, the rights of working class people, health care, education, etc., far in advance of anything we built in this country. Secondly, I think the kind of corollary to that understanding is that in the United States, we've had a Democratic Party that stood in the place of what might have been a labor party and at various points, of course, has claimed to be the party of the working class, claimed to be the party that represented working people, but in fact actually decimated, co-opted, weakened, divided, and at every stage ended up becoming a graveyard of social movements. So that when you look at the history of the United States, so the moment when the left was strongest, the moments, I should say, when the left was strongest, really, was when the left was independent of and organized outside of the institutions of the Democratic Party, challenged electoralism and the kind of narrow confines of electoral politics, and didn't fall into the traps that, you know, basically the kind of straitjacketing of politics that has been the genius of the American capitalist two-party system, where in effect debate is limited to such narrow confines as are defined by two wings of a capitalist party, rather than having in the electoral arena any kind of expression of working class politics. So those two things together, I think, start to be an explanation. Of course, it's not the whole story, but I think it's a very important part of the story.
When you look at what it defines the idea of the left, the idea of a political movement or political force in the society that represents the interests of the vast majority of people versus the interests of the few and the elite in the society, there is not anything resembling a powerful left in the current United States. What do you learn from history, from the history of the left in the United States, which certainly with your work with Howard Zinn, you know the details of very well. What do you learn from that long history that can inform the efforts now to at last, perhaps finally, create, since there clearly is a need given the economic crisis, for the organization of a powerful left in the United States?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to start by asking that question. I think that is exactly the right question to be asking right now. And then, you know, when I think about the book that Howard and I did together, Voices of a People's History of the United States, and the film that we did together, The People Speak, and some of the lessons that I take from the struggles and the movements that we documented in those projects, a few, I think, very relevant lessons emerge for me. One is that no movement starts out as a mass movement. There's never in the history of this country, or as far as I can tell in any country, been a mass movement that just arose overnight. It always starts with that first group of people who are willing to stand up against convention, the norms of the society, the shared and received wisdom of the day, to say that a certain injustice must be fought against. Secondly, it's always involved organization. It has always involved people coming together and being greater than the sum of their individual talents and skills and expertise, but finding a way through collective activity to achieve a larger impact and to find that wider audience that then comes to understand that the injustice that they began organizing against when they were initially an isolated, often persecuted minority, is something that actually speaks to the aspirations and needs of a much larger number of people. I think a third thing that emerges, if you look at the history of struggles in this country and elsewhere, is that progress never takes place in some kind of linear, simple, direct path. There are always setbacks in any social movement, and you have to have the political wherewithal, the understanding of politics, the understanding of what it is that you're seeking to achieve and what's at stake in trying to achieve it, to weather the ups and downs of a particular struggle. And you need to have a certain amount of patience. I mean, yes, you need the impatience that activists have, but you also need to have the patience to understand that it's not going to happen immediately. So, for example, there's been an interesting phenomenon in this country when we had the large protests on February 15th, 2003. You know, by many accounts, perhaps the largest demonstration internationally in world history, a tremendous accomplishment. And yet many people thought that one day of protests somehow would prevent the intervention of the United States into Iraq and the horrors that flowed from that. But many of us understood at the time that actually so much more was at stake for American imperialism in the Middle East and in the invasion and occupation of Iraq, that it would take much more than just one demonstration. It would take a much greater degree of disruption of the normal operations of the system, much more protest and disruption and organization to achieve that. But many people left disappointed and kind of feeling like, well, if that won't achieve our aims, then nothing will, and governments don't listen to us, and they went home. They didn't have the kind of persistence, the kind of patience, the kind of longer-term vision it takes to bring about the kinds of social change that we're talking about against very powerful, entrenched interests that have everything at stake in keeping that change from happening.
Anthony Arnov is the author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, and he co-edited Voices of a People's History of the United States with Howard Zinn, and he also edited The Essential Noam Chomsky. Thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thanks for having me.
This is Alan Minsky, and you're listening to Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Stephen Duncombe teaches the history and politics of media and culture at the Gallatin School of New York University. He is the co-founder of the community activist organization, the Lower East Side Collective, and was one of the main organizers for the New York City chapter of the international direct action group Reclaim the Streets. He is also the co-director of the Center for Artistic Activism. Welcome, Stephen Duncombe.
Thanks for having me on.
The reason I've asked Stephen Duncombe to come in on this first installment of our series is because Stephen Duncombe studies the American media landscape, or mediascape, as it were. He is the author of the book Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy, about which Slavoj Žižek says the book is simply the sine qua non for any revival of leftist politics. We've just spoken to Anthony Arnov about some of the historical backdrop about the left in the United States, certainly the times we're living in. From the 1970s all the way up to the present, the rate of change in terms of the amount of media people consume, the transformations of the media landscape take place now on not just a decade-by-decade basis, but it seems almost on a week-by-week basis. What are your thoughts about how that represents opportunities and challenges for the building of a powerful left in the United States?
Well, it's a good question. We'll start with the challenges. The challenges are how to get any sort of message or unified message out there and have it stick. When literally you have it on any given topic, thousands, hundreds of thousands of different outlets ranging from, you know, CNN down to the blogs, the informal blogosphere, it's really hard to get any sort of one unified message out there. And it's very hard for people to understand, think about, and act upon any sort of unified understanding of the world. And so I think that one of the challenges we have is, what do we do in a world where truths are plural? We're used to having, on the left, the right ideology. We have history in our back pocket. We know how to make sense of the world. And there's been various frameworks that we've used in the past 300 or 400 years, whether that framework be the framework of classic sort of liberalism, or the framework of communism and Marxism, or the, even the frameworks of the sort of the micro frameworks of human rights, civil rights, feminism, so on and so forth. We don't have those unifying frameworks anymore. And then the question is, what to do about that? And, you know, one path to do is do a lot of sort of, well, we've got to get back to that. We've got to get back to that moment where we all agreed on a set of principles, and then we can march forward from that place. And part of me is very sympathetic to that. I would like to actually know exactly how to make sense of the world and how to make sense of all of these ideas that are coming at me every single day, all of these truths, and to be able to package them neatly and march forward orderly. But I think that, you know, that horse has already left the stable. And I think we actually live in a mediascape, which its fundamental characteristic is plurality. And its fundamental characteristic is that every single person has the potential to be a producer of ideas as well as a consumer of ideas. In some ways, that sets up a real opportunity as well. Because I think that in some ways, we're at a moment in which the CNNs, the New York Timeses, and so on and so forth, don't actually, the Fox Newses, don't have a stranglehold on what the ideas, what the predominant ideas are going to be in our world, and that there's an opportunity for those ideas to be challenged in a way that they probably have never been challenged before. Now, the problem, of course, is how do you challenge them and what do you put in its place? You just don't have an endless world of criticism. And I think that that's where we're headed right now, is to try to figure that out. How do we have, you know, grapple with this sort of plurality of media, yet also figure out how to act?
The thing that comes to mind as you're speaking right now is the counter-globalization movement of the late 1990s, which I'm guessing that you were quite attentive to and participated in, given your involvement with Reclaim the Streets. Mm-hmm. The counter-globalization movement, as I recall, and I participated in it myself, seemed to revel in such plurality, and yet, at its core, there is no mistaking the fact that the sort of centerpiece was this critique of global capitalism. How do you reflect back on that movement? What do you think the possibilities for that kind of movement, again, to gain traction within the United States?
Well, I think that that movement's a perfect example of both the weaknesses and the strengths of the contemporary moment for the left. The strengths insofar as, you know, the classic one no but a thousand yeses, you know, that Sub Comandante Marcos said, is that, well, we were all united against global capitalism, but the problem became, well, what actually did we want? And did I want the same thing that you wanted? And did we want the same things that they want? And when we started to, you know, bandy about the slogan, another world is possible, things kind of fell apart because we had no idea with what kind of world might be possible. And so I think that that's that moment we're at now. And I think that, again, that we have an immense ability for criticism and an immense ability to undercut official truths. The problem we're going to have is how do we rearticulate a new truth in this new media sphere where the voice of one great man or one great idea or the right analysis just ain't going to hold. And I have some ideas. I mean, I'm not the first one to come up with these ideas, but I think that they're worth playing with. They're kind of far out, but I think that it's something that the left really has to start looking at. And really it's looking at sort of the cutting edge of the communication and the cutting edge of technology, which is happening around software. And if you look at, say, for example, how open source software is created, it's really created through a collaborative process, yet at the end of the day, you have one good word processing program, server program, or what have you. Similarly, Wikipedia works this way, which is lots of people can contribute to one article, but in the end of the day, you have an article. Now, it's an article and it's a program which is constantly mutating. It's constantly having stuff added to it, subtracted to it, contested features of it contested, but in the end, it ends up with something which people can use and actually move forward with. How can we come collaboratively up with ideas and then have these ideas about where we want to go, how we understand the present and our past, yet also think about those things as constantly revisable and inherently collaborative? I mean, one thing's very important. Our whole notion of politics that we think of as modern politics from the democratic movements of the 18th century up until, you know, the present day have been basically based on a printing press model in terms of disseminating information, linear thought. All of that stems from a way of thinking that we've developed by reading, essentially. Well, that world's gone. It's essentially gone. And we have to think in a new way because essentially every day, you, I, and everybody else is using this technology, which is training us to think a different way.
Two questions. The second one I want you to address is examples of where this is taking place now. But the first one, let's say that there is an idea, and I'm going to use an example that's going to come up later in the week, which comes from a group of progressive radical economists who call for a full employment program to be run by states, the individual states, or by the federal government. Anybody who wants a job gets a job, okay, at a living wage. Let's say you're an advocate for this position. You don't think it's getting enough of a hearing among progressives. There was an opening for Obama to propose something like this, like Roosevelt's CCC back in early 09. He obviously didn't do that. And now, of course, with the Republicans in Congress at the federal level, it seems closed. But there do seem to be some progressive states who may take it up. And these programs actually do exist around the world, and some of them are very successful. So you wanted to advocate this with all of its attended social benefits as you see them. Where would you put this forward?
Okay, one of the things I think you have to think about is, one is, I'm very sympathetic to these sorts of programs. I mean, I have a great nostalgic fondness for the New Deal. But one of the questions is, well, what sort of jobs, and how do we decide as a people in a state, what have you, what sort of jobs are created,
sure,
and what sort of work is done? So I think that's one place when you can have incredibly vibrant sorts of discussion and constant renegotiation of what sort of jobs are done, as opposed to what happened in the 1930s, which is essentially agencies decided what sort of work was done. And I think they did a good job in deciding what sort of work was done, but still it wasn't a democratic process. But the question you put out there, which is, how do you get people to hear about these things?
Right.
Literally, you have Fox News on the one hand, which is just blaring out ideology of the right, and then you have the sort of the objectivity, quote unquote, of the liberal media, which basically makes them indifferent allies because they're scared to take a stand on anything. One of the ways you could do this is, I'm remembering these moments during the Obama campaign in which the Obama campaign really unleashed its fan base, if you will, to create their own posters. They would release fonts on their websites, release the colors on the websites, but basically allow people to do what they want in terms of publicizing the Obama campaign. And what you did is you got incredible stuff. I mean, well, what would happen if this got unleashed again? Okay, let's just say by a state government or even by a federal government or even by a group of organizations. The model of having a lot of different people take the same sort of message but express it in a lot of different ways and publicize it in a lot of different ways, I think is something which we saw a touch of in the Obama campaign but is yet to be mobilized and capitalized upon.
Right, and indeed, and in the example that I threw out there, one could imagine that if you had people participating and chiming in from every community, if the excess labor pool that is now basically collapsing into abject poverty across the United States were able to be mobilized through democratic decision-making for the betterment of the communities, you can only imagine the outpouring of creative suggestions that would come in.
Yeah, I mean, people get engaged with what they feel that they're actually a part of. And if people feel that they have some sort of power, whether in articulating what sort of jobs or even articulating the messaging that goes on around the campaign, they will get involved.
Stephen Duncombe, I want to thank you so much for sharing these ideas with us on building a powerful left in the United States.
Glad to share them with you, and thank you so much for having me on.
This is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Our next guest is Bill Fletcher, Jr. He's an editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com, and I've asked him right now to talk about his sense of what an economic justice movement, a movement that would go up against the long, at least three-decade trend towards neoliberal capitalism in the United States and across the globe, how it would seem in the context of global politics and national politics. Would it inspire people? Bill Fletcher, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're now 2 years plus into the Barack Obama administration. We have a massive economic crisis on our hands in the United States, and the situation seems to call for the formation of a powerful left, one that advocates for the vast majority of people's economic interests. It does not exist. Your thoughts on how maybe such a movement could be built in the United States?
I think that we have to be operating at several different levels. So if you accept for a moment that there is no silver bullet, one of the lessons that can be learned by looking at what's happening in the Arab world right now is that the upsurges that we're seeing are the results of years of work that different social movements, not just one social movement, but different social movements have conducted. And then there becomes that moment when people, for whatever reason, are inspired to move. So, first of all, we have to keep in mind that here in the United States, there's a lot of good people doing great work. The problem is that at this point, we're less than the sum of our parts. Part of what is necessary in order to realize the kind of left we need is that we need a storyline, to be blunt. We need a story that explains the hardships that millions of people are experiencing and why, and really does go to the question of capitalism and doesn't avoid that, doesn't play with other words, but actually talks about the way that capitalism operates. So we need that narrative. We also need a willingness to fight back. I mean, you mentioned we're 2 years into the Obama administration. And one of the tremendous problems that has been encountered by the left and other progressives has been this return to the barracks mentality that took place after Obama was elected. It was as if many, many people, good folks, thought that now that he was elected, we could go back and relax and we'll let him unfold with his magic. And it never works that way historically, and it certainly hasn't worked that way now. So another lesson is that if you don't keep the pressure on elected officials, they will put the pressure on you. And that's what's been happening, and it's resulted in a great amount of despair. Another area is the necessity for an electoral arm of progressive movements that is not reliant on the Democratic Party, but does not at this point look to create a third party, a third electoral party. And this has gotten me into debates over the years with a lot of people that I respect, such as Ralph Nader, where my view is that the nature of the U.S. electoral system makes it extremely difficult for third electoral parties to emerge and to have a great deal of credibility on a national scale. Therefore, in order for the left and for progressives to have an impact in the electoral arena, we have to be willing to work inside and outside of the Democratic Party, but based on our own platform, not somebody else's platform, but a platform that really speaks to the needs of working people. What all too often happens is that many people, very good people, get sucked into the electoral cycle. They get drawn into a particular campaign. The campaign may succeed, it may fail, but at the end of that cycle, it's almost like they're spit out. And they spend the next 2 years showering off before they end up getting sucked in again, rather than the development of a strategy that really is focused on the fight for power. So I think that we on the left have to be A, unapologetic in our critique of capitalism. B, we have to be prepared to reach out to other forces that may not be there just yet in terms of having the same critique of capitalism, but really feel what capitalism is doing to regular people and are prepared to fight back. And they're going to fight back in the streets, fight back electorally. And perhaps one of the biggest fights we need to be doing or conducting right now is organizing with the unemployed and encouraging them to speak up and fight back against what's happening.
My sense as I look around American society right now is that there's a tremendous amount of fear, fear drawn from economic insecurity, and it is hitting the overwhelming majority of the population. I mean, there are certainly secure people, what might be called a professional class, and of course, they're the very wealthy, and we have the very wealthy flashed in front of us constantly in the mainstream media. But fear is really what a lot of people feel. My sense is some of the very, if you go back decades, even hundreds of years, you look at popular revolutions, the popular revolutionaries were telling people, we are promising you a better life. Don't you think, I know that's so basic, it's so rudimentary, don't you think that would be part of a core message of a left, and in that we could really reach a lot of people who aren't even listening to us yet?
It is part of the message. The problem is that people then want to know a few of the details.
Of course. Indeed.
Right? And therein we come up against a problem that we have to be honest about.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is the 20th century experience with socialism, which was a mixed bag. We have incredible accomplishments of countries that embarked on the socialist road. And we have some problems, things like Stalin, that led many people to feel like, whoa, I'm not sure this is the road to pursue. So I think that we on the left have to be able to account and take responsibility for our history at the same time that we're promoting a vision of the future that appreciates people's concerns about what's happened. You see, so it's not like we can ignore the 20th century. We have to deal with it. But that's all part of the issue of the narrative. People have to, in the United States, there has to be this sense that the problems are not the problems that are created by a certain set of individuals. It's not like the collapse in 2008. Was the result of machinations by Jews, which is what the political right would like us to believe, or that it was the result of black people demanding that banks give too much, or that it was simply the result of corrupt people. What we have to be talking about on the left is that it's a system. This is the way the system works. This is a very amoral system that crushes, it's one of those perpetual machines that crushes anything that gets in its way. And it's not about whether there's a good person in command or a bad person in command. There are better people that we can influence and there are worse people. But the bottom line is that the system itself is toxic. And that message is a message that people have to feel in their heart and soul. And I would argue that's a central part of what we on the left need to be about.
We've just heard from Stephen Duncombe, who's a professor of media studies at NYU, and he talks about the need for people to have a space for dialogue where ideas can be shared, where the sort of full flowering of people's creativity within a democratic process can take place such that ideas are exchanged so that something like the third formation that you're talking about can come into fruition. Do you see what you're talking about as sort of a third political formation, not outside the Democratic Party, not inside the Democratic Party, but a place where the left can work out, in a sense, its strategies and tactics? How do you envision that in terms of people participating in it, and then how it would function socially?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and I would divide it up. When I think about the left, I'm thinking not simply people who are to the left of center. I think about the left as being people who are anti-capitalist and against the empire. I think that's how I think of the left. And there is, at the same time, a broader progressive movement that has people who are anti-corporate, anti-racist, anti-sexist, etc. And the left has to operate within that sphere, as well as speak in its own voice. So part of what I would say to you is that we on the left need to be unapologetically on the left. We need to be talking about the way that capitalism works, as I was saying. And we need to be suggesting that an alternative to the system is not only a good idea, it's essential if humanity is to get out of the 21st century. At the same time, there's a lot of people that just aren't there yet. And we have to work with them. And part of this idea of a third force is the idea of political formation that is, in fact, fighting for power, that includes people on the left, but is not exclusive to people on the left. One of my mentors is a man named Jack O'Dell, who was very, very close to Martin Luther King, was an advisor to King, and was also Jesse Jackson's international affairs director for years. He's retired now, but he started exploring a few years ago this idea that he called a democracy charter. And it's very similar to what you were describing, the idea being that there needs to be a document that actually expresses the platform of progressives, a consensus document. And that this document is not a document that can be created by one or two smart people sitting away in a room. It's a document that needs to be the result of a discussion not of academics and not just of activists, but a discussion of people in different social movements and different activist organizations in academia that engage in looking at, for example, a draft of something and start to explore what does this mean for us? What would, for example, be a 10-point program for California, for a progressive California? What would it look like? And we need to engage people. People don't want something pushed down their throats. They want to be engaged in a process of thinking through the future. They may say, on the one hand, well, tell me what we should be doing. But in reality, what adults feel is that they want to know what your views are, but they want to be involved in shaping the final product. And that is one of the roles that I think that the left needs to engage in, to make sure that there's a safe space, to make sure that there's discussion, to recognize that these great ideas aren't going to come from the heads of just a few people.
Bill Fletcher, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Stanley Aronowitz is a professor of sociology, cultural studies, and urban education at the CUNY Graduate Center. Throughout his career, he's studied the ups and downs of the American left. I had a long conversation with Stanley Aronowitz the other day, and this is the part of the conversation where he focuses on what he feels the left most needs to organize around.
The first thing is to realize that although the state of the economy is abysmal and economic questions, questions of equality in wages and benefits and in living standards are, in the economic terms, are important, they are themselves part and parcel of a much larger picture. And let me explain what I mean. We live in a culture of consumption. That is to say, we have allowed ourselves over the last, 70, 65 years, since the end of the Second World War, we've allowed ourselves to be put into a position where almost everything we think we own is owned jointly between ourselves and the banks. Our houses, our cars, our clothing, our education, almost everything. So that we have allowed ourselves to a certain extent to believe that our standard of living is freestanding. But in fact, what we've learned in the last 2 or 3 years is that it's not freestanding. It is really part and parcel of a very complex financial regime, a financial regime which finally, when it collapsed, many of our own situations collapsed. Now, that culture of consumption based on debt, that culture of individual ownership of houses and the car culture, and it goes down the line, is as much part of our own lives as it is the part of the lives of the people. Now, having said that, then the problem becomes, what are we facing? Well, I think in the first place, we're facing an ecological crisis, which is only manifested, superficially, but at least only at the surface, by global warming. We are facing loss of water. We're facing loss of decent air. We're facing a problem of vast land stretches which won't be able to grow food. We may have food shortages in the next generation, and maybe some in our own generation. We're facing abrupt climate change, which in the Northeast and the Midwest in the United States has really hit us very hard in the last couple of years. We have to be able to talk about those things in terms that will be simultaneously intelligible to the American people who are concerned about their economies. I mean, the administration of Barack Obama speaks about clean energy and speaks about things that are often admirable, but at the same time, nobody's been willing to say, and the left hasn't been the most articulate in this area as well, that we have to gradually, we can't do it all at once, eliminate the car as the main form of transportation that most people use to get for and back to work and to their leisure and their weekends and their families. We have to create a vast intercontinental system of mass transit. We have to be willing, for example, to take a, even if when we use cars, we should be able to do that on the basis not of oil, but of electrical energy. The oil companies are claiming this kind of advantage, and there's no discussion about how that's going to happen. Secondly, I think when plants shut down in the Midwest and the Northeast, and even in California, which had a substantial deindustrialization in the late 80s and 90s, especially in the Los Angeles metropolitan area and San Diego, when those plants shut down, it is a function of radicals to say, like in Argentina, like in other parts of Latin America as well, no, we will operate those plants. The workers themselves will take over the plants and run them as co-ops. We're not going to permit our jobs to go away. Now, the United Electrical Workers tried to do that in Chicago, but all they were interested in, for to a large extent, was getting a decent severance pay. They should have said, no, we're going to let this window factory, which we have occupied and we haven't permitted to shut down, run under our aegis. That would be a radical proposal. It would be very difficult to implement. It would still be subject to all the conditions of the market, which are not favorable to worker ownership. But it's not just worker ownership I'm talking about. I'm talking about worker self-management of the processes of production. The left is not a very vital force, I'm speaking in the third instance, in a very basic question that is now roiling American society, which is the question of education. The question of education is really whether Americans, both those who will somehow end up in professions and those who won't, will actually gain an adequate education from the public school system. The public school system does not fulfill any of the three basic requirements of a decent education. The first is knowledge of self. The second is knowledge of the world within which we live. And the third is the capacity to reinvent the society within which we live, at least the intellectual capacity. I don't mean to say that people are going to be able to imagine a new society spontaneously. We don't fulfill that requirement because Americans, to a large extent, are not fully literate. And that's because the public school system has given up on a large portion of Americans and simply permitted a very few Americans, including immigrants, to actually learn literature, art, philosophy, and the social and natural sciences decently. What we have is a political elite which is now talking about science and mathematics because all they care about is basically whether we can be a competitive society with other countries. The problem for us, that is to say of the ordinary people, is that we need a society in which we can take control of our own lives and not be subject to the world's vicissitudes. And the only way we can do that is to have an educational system in which we become critical intellectuals. And I don't mean simply a small group of people who attend graduate school or get PhDs, but actually large parts of the whole population. Part of this, by the way, can be fulfilled by a vital trade union movement. But basically, the most important part of this kind of a perspective, both politically as a struggle and also in terms of institutions, has to be the property of a radicalized left. The left has to itself become an educational institution in addition to being a political position. Then we have the whole issue of health. The most radical proposal that we could be making on questions of health is not what the Obama administration performed in the health care bill, which still requires people to buy health care from private insurance. It's not even the kind of health care that is provided by Western Europe, which actually pays for the health care through their budgets. What we need is a health care system in which people really eat better, where the food supply is really seriously healthy, where the reliance on drugs and medicines gives way to a reliance on styles of life which are much, much more viable and sustainable from the point of view of a much less dependent population. We have to be talking about a critique of health, a critique of a healthcare system in which the private insurance companies, as well as the hospitals and the doctors, really control what happens to individuals in relationship to health. And I think that's a terribly important thing. And finally, I'm just giving a small sample. Henri Lefebvre, who's a great French philosopher and urbanist, developed an idea which is called the right to the city. And the right to the city means that our urban areas have been allowed to fall down. I don't mean only the infrastructure of the urban areas, the housing crisis, the growing crisis in amenities like parks and recreational facilities and in air which is breathable and in food organizations that are healthy. We need to be talking about not having a program of gentrification, which is the capitalist program for the cities, of the Walmarts of this world on one end and the Brendels on the other end, which is a very high nudity department store, but a whole system of food cooperatives, of clothing cooperatives, of community cooperatives that begin to reshape the city in an image that help most of the people of the cities rather than simply the few. And we have to talk class terms on all of these questions. Who controls production? Who controls education and health? Who controls the city? And we have to say, look, this is part and parcel of what is only understood as a process of class struggle. And the problem with the American left is it's lost contact with class. The middle class figment of the ruling elite's imagination has been dominant both in the media and dominate among many groups in the working class, including people like unionists who talk about the middle class. What the hell are they talking about? There are two kinds of middle class that are legitimate. One kind of people who own their own productive facilities or own their own businesses. That's the old middle class. And then there's the middle class of professionals, some of which own their own businesses. They are individual doctors or lawyers or whatever, but most of whom are salaried teachers and engineers and scientists and various kinds of qualified workers who nevertheless face the insecurities of an economic system which is no longer, to a large extent, able to accommodate their needs. We have to reclaim the category of class and really talk about class as a power question. Who has the power? Who doesn't have the power? And we also have to talk about class in terms about equality, that public policy ought to be devoted not to providing America's competitive position economically, but public policy ought to be oriented towards more equality rather than more inequality, which seems to be the whole orientation of every administration since Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
The words of Stanley Aronowitz, a professor of sociology, cultural studies, and urban education at the CUNY Graduate Center. For the special series, Building a Powerful Left in the United States, I'm Alan Minsky, and I want to thank Stan Mizrahi, Spencer Downing, Melissa Figueroa, and Evan Kendall for their help on the show. And if you want to hear extended interviews with the guests today, go to buildingapowerfulleft.org.